Members and those in the audience, I will call our Education Innovation Policy meeting to order unofficially. We do not have a quorum yet, but we can begin our business of the day. And the first bill up is House File 1254. I cannot move the amendment yet, Representative Baker, but at least you can begin to explain the bill. So please explain, Representative Baker, and welcome to our committee. I don't know if you've been before me before, but great to have you. So please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Dave Baker, very proud to carry what I think is a fabulous bill that we need to try to help our school districts and our school boards associations to make sure that we can put out cleaner and better buses. So we've got a very unique bill idea here. And I've got a really good testifier here with Mr. Kelleher. And so, Madam Chair, this is my first time in front of your committee, and I'm grateful to be here. So, again, overall, Madam Chair, members, this is a bill that we are asking to sort of take advantage of a Volkswagen court settlement that's coming to Minnesota that is very focused on cleaning up diesel. And we think that this is a good idea, especially when it comes to school buses. And of the items that has been recognized through the settlement, diesel engines in school and buses in general and specifically have been identified. So we called our friends with the buses and we said, what's the idea? What do you want to do? And I've got a great person here to talk about that, Ms. Chair. So if I may, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you very much and welcome Mr. Kelleher, Mr. School Bus important person. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Certainly. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm the lobbyist for the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. I just have a quick story. My testimony won't be real long this morning because it's morning.
It is morning.
One of my members is a private contractor in the Crosby-Ironton area. Granted, our weather lately has been very warm. However, 6 weeks ago, it was 33 below zero up in Crosby-Ironton area. Diesel fuel is not fabulous at 33 below. It kind of turns into what we call Vaseline. It doesn't flow well. It's expensive to provide additives to blend out the fuel. This particular member says he will never buy another diesel bus again. He has six propane buses now. And what's happened in the industry about, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, the tanks weren't very big. So you could only go about 150 miles on a tank. Now the tanks are big and they're compressed better and you can go 350 miles on one tank full. And that allows you to do a very large school district without having to fill up in between with kids on the bus. So as far as we're concerned, it's a great idea. They are the school buses that are propane equipped are a little more expensive by about 10%, maybe a little bit more. A basic school bus is about $95,000. So these things, the propane ones are, you know, 120, something like that. So a rebate to help us buy propane buses is a fabulous idea. We think it's great. The other advantage is it cuts our fuel costs a great deal, anywhere from, you know, 15 to 25%, depending on which documents you read. So over the life of a bus, 4 or 5 years, you know, the first 4 or 5 years, school buses' lives are usually like 10 years. But basically in the first 4 or 5 years, using propane would pay for the difference in the price of buying a propane bus versus a diesel bus. And so between the fuel economy, the lack of pollution, works well in the winter, those sorts of things, that's our story, and we think it's a great idea.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Members, I will call our meeting officially to order and ask that Representative Jessup moves the minutes from February 21. Is there any discussion or correction? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the February 21 minutes, please say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 21 are approved. Representative Grassl moves House File 1254. And Representative Grassl, there's also an amendment to put Representative Baker's bill in its order. Representative Grassl moves the A2 amendment to House File 1254. Representative Baker, and I better vote on that. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Baker, would you explain what you did in the amendment, just very briefly, please?
Madam Chairwoman, I just didn't have a copy of that with me, so.
I think it's basically clarifications.
Just definitions, technical stuff. Would you, yeah, if I could ask the expert, our researcher to do that, that'd be great. He's going to come up and do that.
Okay.
Ms. Farrell, while you're doing that, members, I'm going to back up and make sure that you know that this House file will be re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. So we need to know that it's moving out of this committee. Ms. Pera.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This amendment makes some technical clarifications. It replaces motor vehicle with school bus, for example, and clarifies the definitions of school and school bus for purposes of the bill. And it changes $30,000 to $25,000 on page 2, which is the funding portion of the bill.
Ends it up a little bit, Madam Chair. Thank you for that.
Yes, Representative Baker, and it clarifies that it's permissive in line 17.
Correct.
That a school that contracts for pupil transportation may apply for a rebate
right.
on behalf of the contractor.
And also, Madam Chair, if I may
Representative
comment.
Baker.
Thank you. We've also, as we learn about this bill and this and the technical side of the awards for the VW settlement is still kind of being understood as well. What I think we may also have to be dealing with, and I think we have another stop on this bill, certainly, and we're going to make this bill better as it moves along, but I think we have to make sure that fueling stations are a part of that, and we're not 100% sure that that's part of the ability to use this fund. So we're going to clean that up, make sure that's right. I think we'll hear from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency today to talk about that, and they've got a couple questions and concerns. So we're going to work. We're committed to working with that because they've been so far identified as sort of the authority of this program, and we're going to learn about this. But we just think school boards and school buses should be one of the very first folks that are looked at on this program. So we'll make this bill better, Madam Chair and members, and we would really appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I believe we have some testifiers. John Thomas, are you present? Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Would you come forward, please, sir, and say your name for the record and give your testimony in support of House File 1254 as amended?
Good morning, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is John Thomas. I'm the transportation manager for the school district Eastern Carver County Schools in Chaska, Minnesota. I do want to start off by saying this is the first time I've ever done this. So a little nervous, and if I screw up protocol, please don't get mad at me or anything like that.
No worries.
So, and I have some notes. As I said, I'm the transportation director for Eastern Carver County Schools in Chaska. I'm here to support this file. I think it's fantastic, and it's long overdue. I'm extremely proud to say that Eastern Carver County Schools, in our partnership with our transportation contractor, Student Transportation of America, have been operating propane-powered school buses in our district since 2010. We've been identified locally and nationally for our success with these buses. For years, I've talked with my colleagues about introducing propane-powered school buses into their own operations. But over and over again, I hear from the districts, whether it be the transportation manager, the superintendent, or the business director, that we just don't have the money. We don't have the seed money to get this started, but we want to do it. With this bill, districts across the state of any size will have that funding opportunity to get this started, and they will see the success that we saw. To give you a brief history, in 2009, I was extremely frustrated with diesel prices and how it was controlling and taking money away from other parts of our budget trying to maintain our fleet and transport our students. I began exploring alternative ideas for school buses through the industry. I looked at hybrid buses. I looked at propane buses. I looked at CNG buses. Really started focusing in on propane buses as the option. I visited a terminal in Los Angeles that had started operating 100 propane buses, and I talked to their drivers, their staff, their mechanics. I drove the buses, and I looked at their fueling system. Student Transportation of America was very willing to be a partner for our district. They had started operating buses across the country in southern states. They were excited about it, and they said, if you want to do this, let's make this happen. My school board and my superintendent backed me. My superintendent had a history with Schwann's Corporation, who has been operating propane vehicles for over 30 years. So as soon as I talked to him about it, he said, do it, make it happen. So we did this without federal grants. We did this without federal funding. We just did it on a chance, and the fact that my administration supported me and my contractor said that they would help out. In 2010, we started operating 18 buses out of our fleet of about 100, and we watched them very closely. Immediately, we saw fuel savings that approximately totaled up to about $3,000 a year per bus. Our buses ran extremely quieter. They were quieter in the neighborhoods. They were quieter to the drivers. The drivers were able to hear the students better and work with them in student management opportunities easier over the diesel engine. As Mr. Kelleher mentioned, there's absolutely no starting issues in the dead of the winter. Our buses are parked outside, and in January when it's negative 20, they still fired up. They did not have to be plugged in. They also warmed up extremely well. Our drivers fell in love with them because they're required to do a pre-trip of the bus before they leave the yard in the morning, and by the time they did that five-minute walk around of the bus, the inside of the bus was warm, and they were leaving the yards with their jackets off already, which you never see happen with a diesel bus. Obviously, then the buses were nice and warm for the students as well. Maintenance was a lot less expensive. It takes less oil, it takes less filters, less time in the garage. We don't have to deal with the diesel particulate emission standards that are now federal standards that are giving diesel buses a lot of trouble. And not only did we stop having to pull money from other areas to take on the fuel, but we were starting to give money back and put money back into the classroom, which obviously is always our goal, especially on the operations side of a school district. You don't want to take money away from the classroom. So since then, just to give you a little update, we're now up to 54 propane buses. We save over $100,000 a year in fuel. The older buses, the original buses, are still performing up to what our expectations are, and the newer buses, the technology, the performance, and everything has improved immensely. We've been able to take advantage of fuel tax rebates that have given us anywhere between $65,000 and $90,000 a year. Additional funding. Our drivers are extremely happy, and as we all know, driver shortage is so intense that if you have a happy driver, hopefully you keep that driver. Because of our success, Eastern Carver County Schools has been referenced in a lot of regional and national stories, and we've been part of a couple of national case studies. So I'm here today to tell you that it works. It's a great asset to school districts to help control their costs. Like I said at the beginning, I've talked to so many of my colleagues that said, I want to do this, but we can't spend that extra money right now. And to have this money available through a grant program gives every single school district the opportunity to take advantage of this and see the success I've had. So I please encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. You did an excellent job in presenting for us your support. Representative Pryor has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Thomas, for being here and testifying for us this morning. I'm sure you're used to early mornings.
Oh, yeah.
This isn't hard for you. I appreciate your testimony. I have two questions, one for the representative, one for you, Mr. Thomas. And am I right in thinking a few years back there was a propane shortage?
Would you like me to answer that? Or?
Sure. In your experience.
So Mr. Thomas, I think instead of shaking your head, because we need to give an answer that's auditory. Thank you.
I wasn't sure if he was supposed to answer.
No, that was for you.
We always have the expert speak.
Madam Chair and Representative, it's a great question. There was not a propane shortage, but a delivery issue a couple of years ago, coming out of North Dakota, and that was a little bit of a challenge for everybody, but everybody I know, including my own school district, our provider said, we will take care of the school district. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about school districts. We have issues with other areas, but school districts will always get their propane. And I know our provider started trucking the propane in from the southern states to make sure that it happened. So, this was now a couple of years ago, and we've not had that shortage since then.
Thank you. Thank you. That was my representative prior. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Representative Baker, this sounds like, gosh, such a great plan and such a great thing to do. Is there competition right now for this money, that there's other groups that would be ahead of the school districts?
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, another great question. I think that you're going to start seeing them line up. I think the general census, and we'll hear from the MPCA too, that school buses are going to be, I think, a favorite for most people. The state's going to get roughly $13 million a year for the next 3 years, give or take. There'll be some other things to come and go. And we've got 10 years to spend that once it is determined and all the details get worked out. So I'm sure that we're going to find a lot of things. But there will be limits on what we can spend it on. So, again, I've learned that the fueling station may not be part of this. We're going to learn more and get into that detail and make sure that this will be right. But when the funds are available, we think that providing school districts rebate programs for this kind of thing will really expand and explode the propane market for this, because, again, now they can do it longer. We've got operators like this that just love these buses. And so we think there will be a lot of competition. That's why we're here early.
Are there other questions for the testifier? Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment from Mr. Thomas. I believe Monday was the first ever school bus driver appreciation day in the state of Minnesota, correct?
Mr. Thomas.
It was Wednesday.
Wednesday. Well, I just wanted to mention that, and please tell your drivers we appreciate what they do. And all the drivers in Minnesota to get our kids to school safely.
Yes, and thank you, Representative Haley. We do want to recognize all the drivers who transport our students every day. So thank you to the drivers. And now we'll hear from those who have concerns, and I think it's, thank you, Mr. Thomas, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I believe it's Mr. Thornton who will testify. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency, and this is my first time at the Education Committee.
Well, welcome.
And I'd like you to know that we love school buses, too. You may not be aware that we've been responsible for providing grant money to retrofit all of the eligible school buses in the state with pollution control equipment to get them up to speed in terms of their emissions through a special federal grant program. We were one of the first states to be able to do that. So we're very happy to help clean up school buses and make them run better. Just a little bit of a background on this VW settlement. VW cheated in their emission standards for diesel vehicles that they were selling in the United States. They got caught. The Department of Justice took them to court and won a $15 billion settlement for mitigation of the pollution the excess pollution that was caused by these diesel vehicles. And that's what this settlement that we're talking about is all about. $10 billion of that money is to compensate the people that bought those vehicles, to buy them back from them at a reasonably decent price. $2 billion is for money that Volkswagen is required to invest in zero emission vehicle infrastructure across the United States. And let's see, what does that leave? About $4.7 billion or so is for mitigation efforts to be done by states and tribes and Puerto Rico. The amount of money that's available to states, it's not just automatically given. You have to apply for it. The amount of money that's available to states is based on the number of these diesel vehicles, Volkswagen diesels that they had in the state. And so the potential allocation for Minnesota is $47 million.
Is that over 3 years?
It's really a kind of a 10-year program.
10-year. Thank you.
It depends on how you request the money and how you plan to disperse it. And the court is going to select a trustee to oversee the disbursement of this essentially private Volkswagen's money to the states. So we have to apply to the trustee to be a beneficiary, and there's a bunch of conditions under that I won't go into unless you have some questions. And to get the money, there are specific conditions on which you can use it, and there are 10 different kinds of categories that are eligible for spending this money on, and they're all designed to reduce the emissions that were caused by the Volkswagen diesel vehicles. Buses are one of the different categories. We've been hearing from a number of other interested parties about some of these other different categories, cleaning up short line railroad switch engines, for example, riverboat tugs, airport ground support equipment, transit buses, and then when it comes to buses, there's a number of ways you can approach them. You can replace the engine with a cleaner diesel engine. You can repower it with compressed natural gas, and as you can imagine, there are some interests there. You can repower it with propane, or you can even make it an electric bus. And in fact, Great River Energy has talked to us about their interest in electric school buses, which might make some sense in some situations. To get back to this bill in particular, our concerns are just locking up what would possibly be a third of the Volkswagen money to this one use before we have a chance to hear from all interested parties. We have just started a series of public meetings. The first one is this afternoon, where we're going to begin getting public input. I'm sure we're going to hear a bunch of ideas. Our intention is to form a technical committee to help us with more technical details. We'd like to understand better what the costs and benefits are of the different options for using the money, so that when we make some recommendations about how it's spent, we have a full picture of everything that's going on. And then, as Representative Baker mentioned, there is a problem with the actual infrastructure piece of his bill that we'll be happy to work with him on. The Volkswagen money is not available for expenditures on actual fuel infrastructure. So, you know, our suggestion is to take a breath and let's get some more input on options for this money before we make some decisions about locking up a significant amount of it for a particular use. I do think that school buses will be one of the things that money is spent on. It's a worthy cause. It helps reduce emissions. It also helps reduce children's exposure to pollution. And diesel particulate is one of the worst forms of pollution that we have in the state.
And thank you, Mr. Thornton, for ending your comments with that statement, because this is the policy committee, so we're really looking at the policy. And in the next committee, I believe some of your concerns will be addressed to a greater extent. Are there questions for Mr. Thornton, Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Thornton, for the another thoughtful perspective on this.
And on the policy, please.
Yes, on the policy. So I'm concerned about, you know, the benefits that you're talking about, and it's not just the cost, but the pollution benefiting the airport or the tugboats, or, you know, where are we going to get the best return on whatever this investment is? And so, but you mentioned zero emissions infrastructure. What are you referring to with that?
Mr. Thornton.
Yes. Madam Chair, committee members, it's a term of art in the transportation sector. Zero-emission vehicles are vehicles that don't emit pollution when they're running down the road. So right now that means electric vehicles and vehicles that are powered by hydrogen fuel cells. We don't have any of the hydrogen fuel cell vehicles in Minnesota. Actually, California has invested quite a bit. So zero emission vehicle infrastructure, which Volkswagen has to spend $2 billion on, is to provide the fueling stations, if you will, for either hydrogen fuel cell vehicles or electric vehicles. We've talked to Volkswagen. They're going to spend it all on electric vehicles. In fact, because of this debacle, Volkswagen has decided they're going to cease production of diesel vehicles worldwide and replace that mm-hmm. with electric vehicles.
Now, Representative Ward, thank you, Madam Chair. And you talked about doing this analysis, and so maybe we're a little ahead of the queue on this. How long do you expect that analysis to take? So when will you have that information so that we could know where we should fit in that?
Mr. Thornton.
Madam Chair, committee members, it's probably going to take a few months. I would imagine that we'll not have some of this out available for people to consider until early summer at the earliest, is my guess.
Thank you, Mr. Thornton, and thank you for your testimony. Closing comments, Representative Baker.
Again, Madam Chair, thank you. We are working this bill through. This is the very first stop. We're going to make it better, and we want to be ready when all the technical policy issues with the MPC are worked out. We want to make sure we're ready at the top of the list, Madam Chair. So thank you for your support.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Grassl renews his motion that House File 1254, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is referred to Job Growth and Energy Affordability. Thank you very much, Mr. Representative Baker.
Thank you.
And then I'll call forward those who are here to testify on behalf of House File 1289. The chair moves House File 1289 to be before the committee. And this bill will be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. And members, I have an amendment as well because the bill was drafted with the incorrect years in place. So the chair moves the A1 amendment, and all it does, members, is delete 2016 and insert 2018, delete 2017 on line 5, on page 5, lines 11 and 12, 2019. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Members, this is a bill that provides funding for advanced placement and international baccalaureate coursework in our high schools. I've long been a strong proponent of these two programs because they have a very high standards and really do prepare our students for their future, whether it be to attend a four-year college or to go into the work world or to attend a career and technical college. We have underfunded this grant program, unfunded actually, not underfunded it, for quite some time, so this would restore some funding. It is designed to create greater access and opportunity, as I said, to rigorous coursework, particularly in this proposal to low-income or disadvantaged children across the state. And our focus is on STEM areas. The second part of the bill continues the ongoing $4.5 million per year funding for AP and IB for professional development. We always used to fund training for our teachers who were teaching these courses, and that has not been available in recent years. And then there's also a piece for test fee reduction for all of our students. Last May, Minnesota students achieved a 3 or higher numbered almost 47,000. That's the number of exams that were taken in which students scored that number to equate to a savings to themselves and their families of $51 million plus. I have several testifiers before us, so gentlemen, welcome to the table, and let's see. Mr. Iverson, I bet you want to begin. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Todd Iverson, and I represent the College Board, and it's a pleasure to be here before you. Madam Chair, just a brief personal note. I had the opportunity to work in this building for about 25 years. I've been gone for a couple of years, so it's nice to be back here again. Before a Minnesota committee, I cover several states, and it's fun to be back. Just a little bit of background for all of you. The College Board, the organization I work for, is a nonprofit member organization that was founded in 1900 with the express goal to improve access to higher education for students. The AP program was started some 60 years ago to deliver excellence in education to millions of students across the country. AP gives students an opportunity to pursue college-level coursework at the while still in high school. We develop the course frameworks for AP classes and develop the exams that are graded on a regional basis and allow teachers in the individual school districts to develop their own their own syllabuses. And they are submitted then and approved by AP, and then the college or the high school teacher chooses how to teach that class. They select the material that they'll use, knowing that it fits into the framework that's been established by both their colleagues, and we have several Minnesota teachers that go to meetings to help develop these courses and the exams. Just a little bit of background. Minnesota has had a long and successful history with AP. There's been support for AP from the Minnesota legislature since 1992. The funding level has been at the current level since 2006, and for AP specifically, AP gets $3 million per year for reduced testing fees and $300,000 per year for professional development. The Minnesota AP program has grown the sixth fastest in the nation over the last 10 years, with over 22% of last year's graduating class having achieved a score of 3 or higher, which equates to receiving college credit for that test exam during their high school career. So there were, as the chair stated, there were 66,000 exams taken last year, with 46,000 of them achieving a score of 3 or higher, and equating to that college credit level. I will state that there is new research out that shows even those students who do not achieve that 3, if they achieve a 1 or 2, are still more likely to finish whatever school they go on to on time, and I'd be happy to share that research with the committee if they're interested. But it just shows that students that choose rigorous coursework or are exposed to that at the high school level do better in secondary school or in higher education. I want to talk briefly about the grant proposal that the chair mentioned. This is a program that's been on the books and was funded for one biennium back in 2006-2007. And then it fell victim to, quite frankly, the Great Recession and budget cuts. And what this grant proposal is designed to do is we tweaked it just a little bit, and it's designed to really focus on rural and underserved schools that may be thinking about starting an AP program or are running into difficulty with the dual enrollment program that is currently out there with the HLC's ruling that they have to have master's degrees to teach those classes now. And so what we're proposing is a 3-year program, and this is this kind of grant proposal program is running in other states. I use Illinois as an example, and it's really a 3-year grant proposal from the time that they're granted the money. The first year is utilized for professional development, creating a cohort of teachers that can teach AP. The second year is focused on student recruitment. On a personal note, I have a high school senior. She's a great student, but like anything else with high school students, she is susceptible to peer pressure, and if her friends are taking a certain class, she likes to take the same classes. And what we found in Illinois is if we can create a culture where a group of students decide to take AP the next year, the program is much more successful. So that third year of the grant is really focused on implementation and allows the school to develop that culture that we're talking about where students take AP.
Students have to become marketers.
That's right. They have to get their friends to do it. The one myth I would like to dispel about AP is that I think 25 years ago, AP was for the smart kids, and it was just the smart kids that took AP. And again, with the research that's been done, we're finding that all students have areas of excellence that they excel in, and if they're exposed to this kind of rigorous coursework, even once in their high school career, they really do much better and have a different view of themselves. So it's not just for the really smart kids. It's for kids that maybe don't do as well in math but do great in history, or don't do as well in history but do well in math. We're really looking to capture those kids and give them that opportunity for the rigorous coursework and help them be successful in whatever path they choose, whether it's going on to technical school or going on to a four-year institution. And that completes my testimony, Madam Chair, and I'll turn it over to John to talk about ID a little bit.
Sure. Welcome, Mr. Peterson, and say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. My name is John Peterson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Association of Ivy Schools. And I want to thank Todd for introducing AP, because usually when I introduce IB, I say it's kind of like AP. They're Coke, we're Pepsi, but we have Mountain Dew. So we have quite a diverse offering of courses, as AP does. The way I'm coming at this from my own personal experience is I was a high school science teacher for 37 years. And when I retired from that position, I was able to continue my work with IB through a different means, as I am here today. And I also have the personal experience of working with a grant program to implement IB in my school. So I was at Park Central High School in the northern suburbs. And for the last 10 years of my career, I was a part-time science teacher, part-time international baccalaureate coordinator, and worked with a Magnet Schools of America grant to implement the MYP, which is the middle years program, and the diploma program, which is most like the advanced placement offerings that we also have at Park Center. So in that experience, and when I saw that this grant was unfunded at this point, as Todd is pointing out to me, that we could move forward on this possibility, I really see it as a great way for us to help explain to people how IB can be implemented in their schools, how this three-year program is actually perfect. If you look at the IB's protocol for becoming an IB school, it takes about 3 years, and the dollar amounts that are available for greater Minnesota schools or even other schools that want to expand IB programs they already have is well suited to the job that we have before us. One of the things we're most excited about in IB is getting the word out to folks, because we are currently focused on the metro area. Most of our 60 IB schools are located within the confines of the greater seven-county metro area. A handful of schools in greater Minnesota do IB, and we know of others that are exploring it, and this would give a great tool to those schools. What most people don't know about IB, International Baccalaureate, is that it's a K-12, actually a pre-K-12 program. And we have a primary years or elementary level program, a middle years, and a high school program, and we actually have two high school programs. And the newest one, called the career-related program, is a perfect fit for smaller, greater Minnesota high schools. My first year of teaching was Turtle Lake, Wisconsin, and with 50 graduates, we could never have done the IB program as it currently existed, or it existed at that time. With the career-related program, you can literally offer 2 to 3 IB courses and then connect that with a certified career technical education program and become what's called an IBCP student. That's the area where we really see it growing. So if you have a mid to smaller sized high school in greater Minnesota and you're interested in exploring this idea, a grant of this size, and our portion of that grant would be up to 25% of this $750,000 that's suggested, a small portion of our portion would be enough to get your school off the ground and allow you to get up and running and get started. I think that, in connection with the world's greatest workforce initiatives that we have in Minnesota, is a beautiful fit. When I've talked to people from the Minnesota Rural Educators Association. We're going to be joining their group as a associate member so that we can speak to their members and bring this forward. But we do also offer the primary years and the middle years programs, and those are programs that this grant would also be well suited to fund, because for, you know, somewhere in the realm of what we're talking about, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year, a school can get started, get their teachers up to speed, get the training done, and begin implementation within 2 to 3 years of their initial exploration. So we're here to support this. We're very excited about the possibility of joining with AP and being part of this grant possibility. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. How many school districts have IB programs in whole or in part now in Minnesota? Because I think the number has decreased.
Well, I'd say thank you for asking that question, because since 2006, when this was first funded, by the way, we get $1 million for test yes. reimbursement and $125,000 for training. Since the time this was implemented, we went from 12 schools to 60. So we currently have 60 schools and 75 programs. So a number of schools, like, for example, Park Center, where I'm from, or where I was, I still think of myself as a pirate, have both the middle years program for 9 and 10, and then the diploma program for 11th and 12th grade, and we're contemplating the career-related program. So we currently have two programs. So we have 60 schools and 75 programs in Minnesota.
Oh, very good. That's good to hear. So I thought the number had decreased, but that's great.
It fluctuates. You know, there have been a couple of schools. I mean, I know back in the 90s when I first explored it myself as a quote-unquote teacher leader in my school, we went down to Owatonna and Fairmont, and neither of those schools still has IB.
That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
But many, many others have come on board since. So.
And Mr. Peterson, it's mostly in the metro area, is it not?
Correct.
Yes. Members, are there any questions for either of these gentlemen? Representative Kunish-Padin.
I don't have a question, but thank you, Chairman. I just want to say I support this. I am a teacher in Robbinsdale, where we have the IB and the elementary level program as well. And I applaud the mission of the program to promote diversity and inclusiveness, as well as give us a global international view of the world and how it affects us. So thank you for all your hard work on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience with concerns about this proposal? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Very good.
Thank you.
With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 1289, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Our last bill today, members, is the Department's Policy Bill. That is carried by the chair. So you could pull out that rather thick file, members. There's also a complete bill summary there. But I believe that our testifier is going to walk through the bill himself. So the chair will move House File 1376 to be before the committee and be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Rick, welcome to the committee. Any updates on the baby as he grows to be what would you call him now? What stage is he in?
Madam Chair, committee members, he is almost 12 months.
So yes. That's a totally different stage.
Yes, very
much so. So he's crawling.
He is crawling. He is standing. He is on the cusp of walking. So we are into the danger zone here.
So, members, this is an employee of the Department of Education, so we should have him introduce himself, but we're always more interested in the baby. So welcome, please.
Madam Chair.
Sorry about that, but babies are really important.
Of course, I'm flattered. Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm always happy to talk about little Xavian, and embarrassingly have pictures flash of him on the screens when I load up presentations. Hasn't happened for a while. So.
Mr. Uni, we'll be waiting for that update when my omnibus bill comes up. Thank you. Will you please proceed to walk us through 1376?
Of course, Madam Chair, members. So if you look at page 1, page 1 to 2, sections 1 and 2 in Article 1, General Education, these connect the statutes on parent authorization for a child to self-carry an asthma inhaler with the statute for the assessment that the child can safely use and possess the medication. So this assessment that the child can safely use and possess the medication is done either by the school nurse or by the medical practitioner that has assigned or that has signed off on the student having the asthma inhaler if the school doesn't have a nurse. We've had some issues with parents and educators being confused about where those statutes align, and so we're just doing cross-references to make sure that parents and educators will look at the statute book and be clear on where those directives lie. On section 3, that's pages 3 to 6, this maintains students awaiting foster care placement as eligible for transportation funding after the federal definition of homeless student removed these students that are awaiting foster care placement from that definition. This is under the ESSA law. So there's no change from current practice. This is just adding in that these students awaiting foster care placement are still eligible for transportation funding.
And, Mr. Ooney, that would be retroactive to
yes.
December.
Yep.
Thank you.
Retroactive December. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, on Section 4, page 6, this makes clear that MDE has the authority to establish procedures governing fiscal audits and internal administrative appeals. There were some concerns from an ALJ that there was possible unpromulgated rulemaking to establish procedures around fiscal audits and internal procedures based on a challenge to them. We believe that it was not the intent of the legislature when they created the statute that it would be require rulemaking, but that we could establish procedures around these fiscal audits and administrative appeals. The administrative law judge suggested that we use another statute, 127.8.42, to establish procedures for these, but that is around violations of law. It's a much more cumbersome procedure for the department and for districts in terms of the paperwork that's required and the process. And so we're just having clarifying language that we believe meets the intent of the legislature when they passed a 127.8.41, that these are MDE is authorized to establish procedures around these internal fiscal audits and internal administrative appeals.
So, Mr. Ooney, will there be availability for public comment under this change?
Madam Chair, members, I believe public comment is specific to the rulemaking process. When we establish internal guidance and procedures, I don't believe that comes under the public comment law.
Thank you. Good. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members, Section 5, which is also on page 6. This changes the current aid payment schedule for debt service aids to school districts from 12 monthly installments to 6 equal installments from July to December. So the reason we're suggesting this is that the timing of district principal and interest payments to creditors around debt service aid is generally set up to lag behind the receipt of property tax settlements from the county. So most of these payments are happening between July and February. So the enactment of long-term facility maintenance revenue in 2015, more districts are receiving debt service aid, and they'll be experiencing more cash flow problems at the time of their February payments. So changing from 12 to 6-month installments from July to December will eliminate these cash flow problems without the requirement of burdensome paperwork to demonstrate those cash flow problems. So we believe that this will create a better flow of funding for districts to meet their obligations without requiring them to engage in paperwork with the department to ask for an accelerated payment. Section 6, page 7, this repeals an outdated definition of American Indian child. So this definition isn't used for funding or any program eligibility currently, as we use the number of American Indian students enrolled in schools, not tribal enrollment. The TNEC, Tribal Nations Education Committee, has proposed amending this definition several times. The American Indian Education Aid Statute, which was passed in 2015, does not state that the funds will be determined using this definition. And the definition we use is the self-identification definition. Members, that concludes Article 1, General Education. Madam Chair, members, Article 2, Education Excellence, Section 1 on pages 7 to 8. This corrects a reference to physical education standards that are the department is supposed to adopt. It changes it from the National Association of Sport and Physical Education, or NASPE, to the Society of Health and Physical Educators, or SHAPE. The reason this happened is that it was originally intended to be the SHAPE standards. Due to a drafting error, the NASPE standards were written into statute. The reviser determined that because neither of these standards are referenced anywhere else in statute, that this was a substantive change and not a technical change, and therefore we're carrying this bill. When we originally adopted the physical education standards, and Madam Chair, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, I believe in 2010,
yes.
Those were the NASPE standards. The new standards that are accepted nationwide from this organization, SHAPE, should be the ones in place. And so we are moving to have the correct standards adopted based on what they are and what the intention of the authors were.
And Mr. Uni, the American Cancer Society supports this, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The Madam Chair, member, Section 1 also changes the date by which the department must make sample assessments for these standards available for districts to the year when the standards must be implemented by all schools. So if the assessments are due before the standards are adopted, we would be in a little bit of a kerfuffle, if you will. We are guided by the statute not to just adopt these standards, but to review and change them or adapt them to what Minnesota schools and educators want. So those assessments may actually have to be reformulated a little bit to match what our standards would be if we end up changing them. And so by aligning when those assessments are released with when the standards are adopted, aligns with the work that we would have to do as well as with expectations from schools, educators, and families. Member Section 2, page 8, this just deletes obsolete standard language. Section 3, pages 8 to 10. If you remember, in 2014, the legislature passed the seals, multilingual and bilingual seals that represent the ability to speak at different proficiency levels, speak, read, listen, and write in different proficiency levels of different foreign languages, including American Sign Language. This would make the current statute says that districts and charters and non-public schools can award world proficiency certificates, but that doesn't exist for non-public schools for the seals. And so we're adding non-public schools as entities that can also award seals.
And charters.
Charters exist in the statute right now. We would just add non-public schools in. But so that it would be districts, charters, and non-public schools that could award not only the proficiency certificates, but also the seals.
Thank you.
Members, on Section 4, pages 10 to 14, this is our proposal that modifies language in the reading well by third grade statute to better support district efforts to meet the needs of early learners and early readers. This corrects language that directs all students not reading proficiently to receive services prior to evaluation for special education. This legislation was passed last year. The language also provides definitions for the statute to provide guidance for educators as they work with their early learner or early readers. States that schools must report on efforts to identify students likely to have dyslexia rather than efforts to identify dyslexia. Finally, there's extensive language to promote a multi-tiered systems of supports to connect various mechanisms of reading interventions and current funding streams to promote a more cohesive system of reading support for all students.
Representative Pryor has a question for you, Mr. Uni.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just could we go back to the dyslexia section again? I want to understand that a little bit better, because certainly we've probably all been talking to constituents about dyslexia and how we are identifying it in our schools. And so is there an impact out there right now for this change, or is this just kind of changing paperwork in the background?
Mr. Uni, please clarify that.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, I'm surface level familiar with the area and how the impact would happen and where practitioners are. We've actually got some members here from my team here who could kind of delve in a little bit if you'd indulge me, or maybe we can address the question after the walkthrough. I'm not sure how you.
No, let's bring them up now. If someone would address that.
If Mr. Ford Guy would be able to speak to this. He's a reading specialist at the department.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Corey Stye, and as Adosh said, I'm the reading specialist at the Department of Education. Representative, the slight modification to the language currently in statute on dyslexia is an acknowledgement that dyslexia is a medical diagnosis, and so the term identify can cause concern and confusion in schools who read that and ask, is this a requirement that really that schools cannot do, which is to provide a medical diagnosis for students. So we are making this slight modification to acknowledge all of the intents of the law, which is that schools need to be assessing students specifically, utilizing assessments that will identify characteristics consistent with dyslexia, and then to provide intervention in order to meet their needs in a way that is evidence-based. And so it's that acknowledgement and clarification of schools don't identify dyslexia. Schools identify and can treat students with dyslexic characteristics, and that the school mechanism for that is that if a student has dyslexia, goes through special education services, they're identified as being a student with a specific learning disability in reading. So it's really just a language clarification to avoid confusion of implementation on the part of districts about is this a new mandate or something we need to do on a medical basis that has not been within school purview.
And Mr. Stein, did you work with the groups who specialize in dyslexia on this? I'm seeing some head shaking, maybe.
Yes.
Mr. Stein, would you answer affirmative or negatively to that?
Yes, we have worked with a couple of dyslexia groups, in particular on a couple pieces of legislation, including this one, and have received acknowledgement of the difficulty of this particular language piece, and have been diligent to try and keep the intent of a focus on an increased awareness of and capacity building towards meeting the needs of dyslexic students.
Representative Pryor, follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I know that, you know, from the parent's perspective, as we try to sort out and, you know, help a child that is likely to have this condition, people were comparing it to autism, that there is educational autism, which gets them identified and then gets them into a special the right help. Is this getting children closer to appropriate support? Because part of the discussion that we had with constituents was that the child is likely to have dyslexia, and then they say, well, that's a medical diagnosis, and then they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, no, that's about reading, so you should go to the education people, and they'll tell you what to do.
Mr. Stein?
So there's a couple pieces involved here, Madam Chair. The first being that there is a mechanism for identifying students with dyslexia with a specific learning disability to kick in specific protections under an individualized educational plan. And so this being the general education reading intervention law that governs all students, we are really trying to focus here on identification of those characteristics with an implication that if a student presents those characteristics, that under the parent and family engagement portion of this law, that those conversations will be had with parents to clarify not only what has presented in the school system, but options that are there. And I'd also point out the extensive document, about 45-page document on our website that was created with a variety of stakeholder groups, including many members from the dyslexic community, as well as clinical psychologists and such, specific to helping navigate the system, the complexity of having a medical term different from the educational term. And at the end of the day, with this law, we want to ensure that regardless of whether you have a label or not, you get service, that we're not avoiding labels, that we're not avoiding the term dyslexia in any way, but just making sure that we have clarification about what students' needs are, the interventions that are necessary for that, and at the end of the day, whether a student has a medical diagnosis of dyslexia or not, or frankly, whether it has identification as having special needs, that there are specific instructional strategies schools should be employing in response to the characteristics identified by their assessments.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. You know, if you feel that this is not exactly the way you think we should be addressing it, feel free, you know, to think about amendments. Members, you're welcome to amend the policy bill. Mr. Ernie.
And Madam Chair, members, Representative Pryor, we've been working with the Decoding Dyslexia of Minnesota with the language. We've shared it with many stakeholders. Obviously, this is our proposal on the creating a framework around this, but
correct.
I want to welcome input in terms of tweaks and different lenses on this so we can make it meet the goals that everybody feels that it should.
Thank you very much, and members. This is the department's policy bill, so please provide your input. That's very important. Will you proceed, please, Mr. Uni?
Thank you, Mr. Stye. That was very kind of you to come forward.
Madam Chair, members, I'm just trying to find my place again. Okay. If you look on Section 5, this is pages 14 to 16, here we are removing the requirements of including off-grade testing in statewide mathematics and reading assessments for grade 3 through 8. So essentially what that means is the test will still be adaptive within the grade level. What we're removing is above-grade and below-grade test questions that we would have on the MCA test. This would, we estimate, remove between 18 and 15 questions per test in that grade span for the testing.
And, Mr. Uni, remember, I'm waiting to hear from Jennifer Dukin.
Yes.
Remember, we agreed that she would contact me.
Yes, Madam Chair.
She's in charge of testing and assessment at the department, and I just needed some clarification. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members, if you look on Section 6, page 17, this creates our proposals to create a clear definition in statute of concurrent enrollment. There's been some confusion with the way the statute is currently constructed, and we're splitting out the actual definition of concurrent enrollment. On Sections 7 and 8, pages 17 and 18, we're providing some clarity, again, in this PSEO concurrent enrollment statute by separating statutory language on post-secondary enrollment options for 11th and 12th graders and concurrent enrollment for 9th and 10th graders. So the language will be split from one paragraph into two paragraphs, merely to provide clarity for parents and educators. Madam Chair, members, on Section 9, page 18, we'll be increasing the time allotted for the department to calculate post-secondary enrollment options payments from 30 days to 45 days after the receipt of enrollment information each quarter or semester. This has to do with the scheduling of our system aid payments, that they're on the 15th or the 30th of each month. We need to have those payments calculated a few days before the payment date. Sometimes it's difficult for MDE to thoroughly review data and complete the data entry in time for the payment cutoff date. So if we extend that by 15 days, we'll allow ourselves more time, or staff more time, to be able to calculate those payments and increase or reduce the error rate that would occur. On Section 10, this makes clear that online learning providers may not discriminate in their admissions process, or must follow discrimination law for their admissions process. So under current law, providers may adopt admissions criteria by board resolution to limit enrollment. There's not clear specific guidance about maintaining enrollment limitations on criteria, non-discriminatory criteria, just like meeting academic prerequisites or the number of students already enrolled. So this is just making sure that we have the safe language in there in law to assure that the enrollment process is fair. Section 11, for the purposes of charter schools, we're providing a definition for education service provider, charter management organizations, educational management organizations, or school management organizations. Section 12, as required of districts, that was passed, I believe, in 2015. Charters will also have to assure that students are not placed in the classroom of a teacher who is on a formal teacher improvement process. If the student was in a classroom in the prior year with a teacher who is disciplined for performance. So this was passed in 2015, and the way the law was written was just written districts and for those that may not be familiar, many statutes that we have in the law book, you explicitly have to write in that it applies to charter schools. Mm-hmm. We believe that this is from an equity perspective, that all students should have that opportunity to be taught by an effective teacher. So if this requirement for placement of a student with an effective teacher applies to students in a district school, it should also apply to students who are in charter schools as well. Also, in Section 12, this just clarifies that charter schools must comply with the People Fair Dismissal Act. In Section 13, states an authorizer that withdraws from chartering schools must also notify all families whose children attend the charter schools that are in that authorizer's portfolio. In Section 14, this states that a charter school may not enter into a for-profit or non-profit, may not enter into a contract with a for-profit or non-for-profit entity that's defined in Section 11 that I mentioned that is headquartered outside of Minnesota. The language states that all educational staff of a charter school must be on contract with the charter board, and the entity defined in Section 11 cannot employ or contract for services or charters educational staff. So, as stated, all educational staff that provide services to the student must be employed by the charter school board.
Oh, Representative Pryor, I'm sorry. I'm busy reading here. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Would this have a direct impact right now on any charter schools that they're contracting with someone outside Minnesota?
Mr. Ooney.
Madam Chair, I don't have the information. I would like to see if our Assistant Commissioner, Kevin McHenry, who oversees charter schools, would be able to come down and maybe answer some questions.
I think, Representative Pryor, we have several in the audience who have concerns, so I think when that occurs, we'll hear their concerns, and then we can call up the assistant commissioner to get the other side of the story. Thank you, Mr. McHenry. We'll just wait. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members, on Section 15, charters, this has to do with charters merging. So charters intending to merge that have a different authorizer must submit a change in authorizer request under the statute governing mutual non-renewal. If that request is approved, the merging charters must be approved to serve the grades and sites of the merged schools under the existing statute for adding grades or sites. Merging charters with the same authorizer, but that have different grades or propose to operate at additional sites, must submit for approval under the existing statute for adding grades or sites as well. It also clarifies that each school approved to merge must submit a separate year-end report for the previous school year. This is basically the current statute doesn't provide clear guidance for MDE with the mechanisms for reviewing proposed mergers in these two situations. So we're providing some clarity in statute so that MDE has some clear guidance and clear authority to have this process set in place. In Section 16, if an authorizer and charter mutually agree not to renew the charter contract, the authorizer must notify families of the children attending the charter of the date of withdrawal, the process of changing authorizers, and the possible outcomes of that process. So this is just in the name of transparency to the families. In Section 17, this requires the alignment of admission enrollment requirements between the charter's pre-kindergarten or preschool and their K-12 systems. So right now in statute, there's requirements around enrollment admission processes for charters K-12 systems. We want to align their pre-K admission enrollment requirements with their K-12 so that they're intending to admit under the same rules the people at either point in time. In Section 18, this is also connected with Section 14. This requires educational staff at a charter school must be employed or on contract with the charter board. And then, with Section 11, which defines charter management organizations, so a charter entering into a contract with one of those entities annually must submit all contracts about the dealings with those entities and amendments to the department. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2, Education Excellence.
Please proceed to Article 3.
Madam Chair, members, Article 3, teachers. On Section 1, we have language to make the St. Croix River Education District eligible to receive QCOMP revenue. So SCRED, as it's called, was organized for Rush City District, is the fiscal host for the cooperative. So Rush City reports all staff employed by Rush City and SCRED, even though the staff are assigned to this education district cooperative under their management and governing board. So we're clarifying in statute now that the cooperatives are eligible for 3,000 times the number of teachers employed by the cooperative. So it's clarifying that this district would be eligible to receive aid for their for the teachers that are that work there, that are assigned there.
So, Mr. Ooney, they are not presently receiving this?
No.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, under Section 2, this creates a definition for positive behavioral interventions and supports, or PBIS, and this includes what constitutes effective school-wide implementation of PBIS. So currently there are references in statute that refer to PBIS, but they're centered in the context of problem behavior alone, and that may lead people to incorrectly conclude that PBIS is only about restrictive procedures, or outside of problem behavior, just about special education in general, instead of in the school-wide context about prevention side and interventions before more of the severe behavior arises. So we're really adding this definition to make people aware that this is much more of a robust system about a school-wide context. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 3.
Please proceed to Article 4.
Madam Chair, members, Article 4, Special Education, Section 1, which is aligned with the last section I talked about. This is just creating consistency for the definition of PBIS by referring to the newly created definition in the last section. On Section 2, we're clarifying that the department is only authorized to approve on-site education programs, so this removes approved to clarify that the Department of Corrections or Human Services licenses children's residential facilities, not MDE. And we're replacing the term care and treatment facility with children's residential facility to also clarify that under this statute, facilities are licensed by the Department of Corrections and Department of Human Services. This is the terminology that they use, so this is really a statute alignment issue. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 4.
And finally, Article 5.
Yes, Article 5, self-sufficiency.
Not finally, we have Article 6 too, sorry.
Madam Chair, members, Article 5, self-sufficiency and lifelong learning. There's only one section. This aligns the timelines and measures included in Minnesota Adult Basic Education Performance Measure Statute with the changes in federal requirements. This will provide a single set of timelines and measures for efficiency. So, for example, the state and federal law require the same follow-up performance measures, but we have different timelines. So Minnesota statute, we collect in the first and third quarter for follow-ups on job performance, and federal is second and fourth quarter. So we're aligning those statutes. And the work that the department, the work that the statute says that the commissioner and the department are doing is the work that the department is already doing. So there's no new requirements created in here. This is really just bringing the statute up to date with current practices as well as with the alignment required with federal law. That includes Article 5.
And finally, Article 6.
And finally, Madam Chair, members, Article 6, Library, Section 1. This clarifies that the department may provide advice and assistance on library administrative issues to school libraries. The current statute limits MDE's role with school libraries to provide to providing assistance. MDE's role in libraries providing assistance to post-secondary institutions, state agencies, governmental units, nonprofit organizations, or private entities. So this is just clarifying that the department can provide assistance to school libraries.
And Mr. Ooney, on Library Day yesterday, I mentioned this to my visitors, and they were happy for that clarification.
Madam Chair, that is very good to hear.
Thank you, Mr. Ooney. Members, we have quite a few with concerns who are going to come forward to express their desire for perhaps change or clarification from the department. So we'll call them forward, please. But first I want to recognize all the, thank you, Mr. Ooney, recognize all the FFAers who are in the audience. Would you please stand? And if you could shout out the school district that you might represent, starting here with the gentleman in front. Yes, you, sir. Thank you. Let's hear the school districts.
Glencoe Silver Lake.
Okay.
Glencoe Silver Lake.
They're all named. Okay, very good. Welcome to you. Representative Erdahl, are those yours?
No, those would be Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, Representative Grunhagen.
Glencoe.
The other side of your district. Yes. Well, welcome. And in the gallery, please shout out.
We're all from Gaston Pedro
Representative Birdall. Thank you very much for coming to our hearing, and I think Representative Birdall is especially pleased that you came here to see him in operation. Very good. Thank you to all of you students for the good work that you do through your organization, because you are really making a difference with all of the different projects that you take on, the leadership that you develop. We are very proud of you and continue to do that. Now, we need to go to concerns in regard to the department's policy bill, and I'll call forward Ms. Brandy Burris Gallagher from Ed Allies and Mr. Antonio Cardona from Pillsbury United Communities. Yes, and pages you need to be adding perhaps extra seating if needed. Just be aware. I think they're taking care of themselves, but... Welcome, and thank you for coming this morning. Please say your name for the record first and then express your concern.
For the record, my name is Brandy Burris Gallagher. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. As I said, my name is Brandy Burris Gallagher. I'm a policy director at Ed Allies, which is a nonprofit advocacy organization that seeks to ensure every kid in this state has access to an excellent education. In my role at Ed Allies, I have the pleasure of working in partnership with charter school leaders and authorizers from across the state, some of whom are here today to share some of their concerns. This morning, I would like to quickly share some of our concerns with the proposed changes to charter law in House File 1376. Our first concern is regarding proposed definition in Section 11E of 124E. We fear that this definition is overly broad. Specifically, it lumps each of these entities, education service providers, charter management organizations, educational management organizations, and school management organizations into one-size-fits-all definition. And they do this even though these entities and organizations have real different meanings in the real-world application. Our second concern is regard to Section 14I, which would ban Minnesota charter schools from entering into contracts with these newly defined entities if they're headquartered outside of the state of Minnesota. This proposed language would place really significant barriers on initiatives launched by charter authorizers to empower parent and community-led efforts to turn around their lower-performing schools and their portfolios. Charter schools like LoveWorks, who you will hear from shortly, have entered partnerships with high-performing charter school operators who are based outside of the state to manage their school improvement efforts. And it's our fear that the language in House File 1376 would stop this work. Additionally, we fear that the negative impact would extend beyond efforts to turn around schools and would also chill efforts to innovate, as charter schools like Venture Academies have entered partnerships with nonprofit charter management organizations, again, headquartered outside of the state, to use technology and customize their personalized learning to really meet the needs of their students. Again, our fear is that the language in this bill would shut down those partnerships and that work. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, but for now I'd like to turn it over to my colleagues, Antonio Cardona and Jenny Carroll.
Very good. Please say your name for the record. Be sure you're speaking into a microphone and begin.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Antonio Cardona. I'm the Director of the Office of Public Charter Schools at Pillsbury United Communities. So primarily, as Brandy was speaking about, we're here to address Section 14, Subdivision 3, I, and J. Before that, though, the mention around authorizers notifying families around mutual non-renewal, I think we would have a challenge with, primarily because we don't have access to student-level data or family contact information, so it would be unclear how we would actually go about doing that. As Brandy mentioned, Pillsbury United Communities has been out front in the last couple years as a way to recognize that authorizers do have a role in catalyzing significant school improvement efforts and working hand-in-hand with families, community members, and board members in turning around low-performing schools. The charter sector has seen an increase in these efforts over the last few years. Pillsbury United Communities, NEO, Audubon have gone down this path. So as a part of this, having access to high-quality CMOs and EMOs, regardless of where they're headquartered, is essential for our school improvement efforts. We now have about four schools that are working on these significant efforts, and one thing that we've learned is we need a pretty differentiated strategy around them. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to how you improve a school. Some will just require a leadership change. Some will need a high level of operational shifts, and sometimes it will include contracting with a CMO or an EMO. Currently within the Pillsbury-Ned Communities portfolio, we have two charter schools that contract with the CMO. Minnesota Math and Science Academy in St. Paul contracts with Concept Schools, which is headquartered in Chicago, and LoveWorks Academy of the Visual and Performing Arts, which contracts with Distinctive Schools, which is also located in Illinois. So the question would be is, you know, the schools that currently have contracts with these organizations, what happens to them? Would they have to cease those contracts, and because they make up the significant amount of the operational and academic oversight and management, that the improvements that we've seen would essentially go away? So we feel that it would be counterproductive to work that has already been underway. You'll hear from Tierney Carroll here in just a second, which now we're probably going into our third year of the effort, wrapping up the first year of full implementation. For paragraph J, as to whether boards or the EMO CMOs would hold educational staff contracts, it's our belief that that actually must be a board-level decision. Again, there's not really a one-size-fits-all approach to what these relationships should look like. So the decision is specific to each school, and as such, should not be legislated. The question of who holds the contracts is about what works best for each school and whatever service provider they may or may not choose to work with. Thank you.
And Ms. Carroll, please say your name for the record and speak into the microphone. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tierney Carroll. I have the privilege of being the board chair of LoveWorks Academy. It's a K through 8 charter school serving students from North Minneapolis with a personalized learning model that incorporates the arts. I'm the mother of a former LoveWorks student and the grandparent of two current students, and I believe in what LoveWorks is trying to accomplish and what it can be for the children and families of North Minneapolis. It's a place where they can achieve academically, where they are encouraged to be proud of who they are, and they're loved by their teachers and the communities that surround them. Unfortunately, when I joined the board 2 years ago, I learned just how far away we were from our school meeting our academic goals. We were also given a mandate by our authorizer, Pillsbury Communities, United Communities, to turn it around academically or to close. Time was of the essence, and closure was not an option for our students in our school. To meet that mandate and save our school, I joined other parents and school stakeholders and formed a turnaround committee. We learned together about the characteristics of high-performing schools. We defined the core of what LoveWorks is so that we could preserve it during the turnaround process. We knew we couldn't do it alone, so we issued an RFP to find an operator, a CMO who could manage and dramatically improve our academic performance while respecting and honoring our school's culture and identity. This is a first-of-its-kind, community-driven turnaround process. It led us down the path to two qualified CMO prospects. One was Minnesota-based, and the other was Chicago-based. We chose Distinctive, which is based in Chicago, because they had the infrastructure needed to manage our turnaround efforts and the experience needed to support our current student population of K through 8th grades. We are fortunate to be under contract with Distinctive Schools since last summer. During the first year of partnership, Distinctive has helped us to make significant improvements in school culture and our learning environment, making it more flexible and responsive to individual student needs through the use of personalized learning. Most important, our early formative assessment data suggests that the turnaround is working. We're seeing significant student academic growth. Our students are back on the path to being academic scholars, and they deserve the best from those taking the lead in their education. So if we're unable to continue our work with Distinctive as a result of this proposed legislation, the progress, the work that we've done as parents, as a community, to assume responsibility for our students' academic success would be undone. The academic progress of almost 200 students will be affected. We need the comprehensive services of a CMO to assist in this transformation. A CMO with a track record of delivering high levels of student achievement with students of color and students growing up in low-income communities, and operational supports an organization with internal capacity can't provide. We chose Distinctive because it was the best choice for our community and other communities and schools who need support to affect dramatic school improvement should have choices, in-state or national, so that they can do what's right for their children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Carroll, and to all three of you. Are there questions for those three testifiers? Thank you. You'll stay around just in case there are questions later. Mr. Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. And Mr. Bartholomew, will you come down too, please? And that's all I have on the list for concerns, but I will call for other concerns if there might be some. Welcome, Mr. Piccolo. Good to see you this morning. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, which is a membership organization of charter schools and authorizers. I would like to make 4 points regarding this legislation. First, we appreciate the department including language about the definition of charter schools enrollment. This is something we've been seeking to have put in legislation for a number of years to align that charter schools also include pre-K programs and some preschool programs. And so this is a good recognition that that exists because authorizers and charter school contracts include that oversight as part of that, but they've been outside kind of the law in that regard. Second, Mr. Cardona mentioned earlier in his testimony about the concern about authorizers having to notify all parents if they withdraw as an authorizer or if they are revoking the charter. We strongly believe that is the role and responsibility of the charter school board, not of the authorizers. As was mentioned, authorizers do not have access to information on individual students or families, and under privacy laws, unless a school publishes a school directory, that information is private. And so this puts a burden on authorizers and takes the responsibility off the board where it belongs to notify its parents. Third, the section on mergers of charter schools, while we appreciate the department's focus on the merger issue, and we've had discussions with them about this issue over the last couple of years, if you look at their language, it's about process and when forms are submitted. We do have legislation that is chaired by the
chair,
that is coming forward that deals with what are the conditions under which a school can merge with another school. It is not just simply about getting the forms in and getting approval of authorizers, but we believe that if two schools are going to merge, there needs to be a similar culture, similar type program, and so that there is a successful merger, not a merger of two different kind of programs. If one is a language immersion school and the other one's going to be a art school, it's not going to be a very good fit in terms of culture or in program or services to students. So we have legislation in that the chair has authored that deals with the content of mergers rather than just the process. And the fourth area I'd like to address is this whole issue of CMOs, education service providers, and so forth. We've had discussions with the department for several months about this issue, and they've taken a different approach than we are taking. We believe the approach in this bill, current bill, is a meat cleaver approach. And in the bill that the chair has authored, we do deal with the distinctions between a CMO, which is a nonprofit organization, an EMO, which is a for-profit, and we also deal with online service providers in that legislation. And our focus in that legislation is about transparency and accountability, that when schools enter into those kinds of contracts, there should be transparency in terms of publishing it so that everybody knows up front what's in that contract, because they involve significant amounts of money. And then in terms of accountability, there should be a reporting of what those monies are spent for in the same categories as other expenditures in the charter school or any public school, using the state accounting system and categories. So we have a comparison of costs across all the different ways of doing things. So we would urge a more nuanced and strategic approach rather than just a cleaver approach to dealing with EMOs, CMOs, and online service providers.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. We also have in the audience Teresa Prevett. Ms. Prevett, would you come forward too, please? Welcome, Mr. Bartholomew. Say your name for the record and begin.
Hi, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. While we support the department's goals in reducing the time needed for student testing and improved reporting.
So, excuse me, members. So, Mr. Bartholomew, your comments are about the entire bill, correct?
Madam Chair, yes. So, two particular
issues. So, members, this is not in regard to the charters. So,
in just a second.
Please proceed.
I had it in reverse order, perhaps. This is about the provisions on page 15. Reversing basically the last several years of
Section
changes
five members
to the MCAs and the adaptability above and below grade. We're not necessarily opposed to the changes, but again, this is kind of a 180 from what's been happening the last few years, and we'd just like a better understanding of why now we're going to do a 180 and what are the long-term impacts of that. It just raised concerns, and we'd like to work more with the department on that. And again, it's kind of a change of policy that comes out of nowhere. And similarly, we also support the efforts of the department to maintain accountability for charter schools. But again, like you've already heard from a number of people, and I won't repeat it all, but we have concerns with the changes on page 23 and elsewhere, why we would draw a distinction between service providers of any sort for charters within Minnesota and then specifically exclude anybody from outside the state of Minnesota. It doesn't make sense to us in the sense that you're not only talking about educational services, as the folks from LoveWorks spoke, but also financial and operational services. The same with the required report at the top of page 27. I'm not sure that we require that of our district schools. Why would we go that extra mile for charters? They're public schools, too. We support the efforts to maintain and build accountability, but as you've heard, I don't know as I'd use the term a meat cleaver approach, but it seems a little bit broader than it perhaps needs to be. Thank you,
Mr. Bartholomew. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Therese Prevett. I am the principal of North Metro Flex Academy, a new charter school which opened in September 2016. I'm voicing my concerns regarding Section 14, Line 2314. A charter school may not enter into a contract with a for-profit entity or a nonprofit entity that is headquartered outside of Minnesota. Our school is... We currently enroll 155 students from very diverse cultures. 70% of those are free and reduced lunch. This is, I've been working in the field of education for 37 years, in charter schools for 20 years in Minnesota. Right now we have a CMO, which is Excel Schools, based in McLean, Virginia. Before that I worked for Edison Schools, which is based in New York City. So most of my teaching and administrative career has been with out-of-state CMOs. And this has allowed us a lot of access to new ideas from across the country, innovation, creativity that is not limited to the state of Minnesota. After a few years of planning, we opened our newly renovated elementary school on the site of a former computer testing facility in North St. Paul. Our students were able to begin school in a building that was fresh, new, and ready for them. We have an independent school board who chose to contract with Excel, and they assisted our school with building renovation, permits, kitchen and office equipment, curriculum, and everything we would need to open in September. Our contract with Excel has been submitted and approved by MDE in approving for startup grants and implementation grants. So everything has been submitted to the state. They've seen our contract with Excel and went ahead and approved our grant applications. We've had a very strong start, strong enrollment, quality infrastructure, strong leader with coaching from administrators from across the country. Some questions that I have: if this bill passes and becomes statute, how will this affect schools already in operation working in conjunction with an out-of-state management organization? Did MDE consult with schools or authorizers of the affected schools? What will happen to our students who are planning to stay with us, possibly through eighth grade? We are overseen by an independent board of directors. Our authorizer, NEO, Novation Education Opportunities, the Anton Group, a Minnesota finance service with a wealth of experience with charter school finance. They assist us in creating our budget and monitors our financial transactions, and a variety of other Minnesota vendors all working towards making our school successful for kids. So we are very concerned that if this passes, that we will be shortchanging all of the students and the promises that we made to the families that we would be offering them an innovative quality school for their children for the next 8 years. And we just were approved to open in September. Or we just opened, I should say, in September. So it's very concerning to our school community.
Thank you, Ms. Cravett. I'd like to call down Assistant Commissioner McHenry to make some comments on this section of the policy bill dealing with charter schools and what has prompted. Thank you very much, Ms. Prevett. And let's listen to his answer starting in Section 11, 124E.02 and follows. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McHenry. Please say your name for the record to begin.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. First off, thanks for having the opportunity to have us talk about this. I do want to say I appreciate all the charter groups that did come up and express concern or support. One thing in particular I really want to commend you on and the authorizers is that our authorizers serve such a huge role here in the state of Minnesota, and the more they're involved in these policy discussions, we think that's better for the charter laws as they move forward. A couple of things that that prompted us to bring this legislation forward, and we have had conversations over the last year or so on how do we, on this emerging issue of CMOs and EMOs coming into the state of Minnesota and the charter law. First off, we've had the definition of EMOs, CMOs, and online service providers. What we are doing here was aligning this with the federal definition. I understand the concerns that were raised of maybe having to separate these. We're open to continuing to find ways to discern between those different organizations, but what we want to make sure is that when we're applying for our federal grants so we can receive federal startup charter school funds, that we're in the best position possible. And as the CMO and EMO are expanding and growing throughout the country, we just want to make sure that we're in the best position possible. So this was our attempt to align our language with the federal language just around CMOs and EMOs. In terms of the merger language, the rationale for us bringing this forward came actually from a proposed merger from an authorizer that was actually holding a school accountable through the contract the authorizer had with their own charter school. The charter school was not meeting the performance expectations with the authorizer. The authorizer had put the school on a performance management plan and ended up in a situation where they were going to unfortunately close the school because the school did not improve to the authorizer's liking. What we found was kind of a loophole in law where the school, rather than being held accountable by the authorizer, which is what their job is, the school was looking at ways to merge with another authorizer, and the current authorizer really had no role of holding that school accountable. I understand that Max is bringing forward a different type language that might have a lot more to it, but the purpose of this was to make sure that when an authorizer is managing its portfolio of schools, it does have the power to actually oversee those schools. One more thing before I get to the actual out-of-state, which has raised a lot of concern. On the notification piece, the rationale for why we wanted to include the notification if an authorizer was going to withdraw is when a charter school closes or an authorizer goes out of business or decides to close, that's impacting a lot of families, a lot of students. And right now, charter schools do have to inform all the students when they are going to, or all the families when they are going to be closing. But what we have in process right now is, let's say an authorizer withdraws. The charter school might be in a position of limbo for a little bit of time. They need to find a new authorizer where they have the same goals so they can continue to operate. And a family of a student may be in a position where there's a charter school in limbo where they may or may not transfer to another charter school. And we just thought it was important for families to have all of this information when they're making a decision on where to send their kids. Now, I understand there was a good point raised about what information authorizers do have. We do have a significant amount of data sharing agreements with charters, so they make sure that they do have, or with authorizers, I apologize, so that many of them do have access to data in their portfolios so they can help manage their portfolio of schools. Our end goal is to make sure that we're communicating as much as possible with families that could be impacted by an authorizer going out of business or withdrawing, and making sure families have all the information to make those decisions. In terms of the CMOs and EMOs and the prohibition from operating outside of the state, our purpose in this is to provide as much transparency with public funds and as to where those are going. We are open to continuing having this discussion. This is something that we've raised with the emergence of EMOs and CMOs. We have not had a definition in statute, although we do have requirements of CMOs and EMOs presenting their contracts or providing their contracts to the department. So first we wanted to make sure that there was a definition of CMOs and EMOs. Now also what's happening is we're hearing, we've heard from authorizers, we've heard actually from charter schools too, where they've been in a position where the EMO or the CMO is saying that in order for us to be as effective as possible, that we need to be able to operate without having, let's say, the board making a decision on a vote. So the EMO or the CMO would come in, they're providing the curriculum, they're providing the educational services, and they want to be able to be as, let's say, nimble as possible. And our viewpoint on that is that if that happens, then there's no way for the parent or the family to actually go to the board, the charter school board that's actually representing the families, to make any changes, because sometimes these CMOs and EMOs can be empowered to make these decisions. So what we want to do is create some more transparency. What happens is when those the EMOs or CMOs are out of state, that makes it even more difficult for the parents if the boards may have given away their or given authority to the CMOs or EMOs, makes it even more difficult for the parents to contact the state. So that's why we did that, and I apologize on that for going too long here, Madam Chair. But we are open to continue discussing this with Max and the Association of Charter Schools. I appreciate the concerns that were brought forward. Those were valid, and we're willing to continue having this discussion with you all and with advocates.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry, and we appreciate your willingness to work with the with Matt and with all those who have expressed concerns. Thank you very much, because we need to work this out. Charters are a great part of our public education, and So we appreciate your comments. Thank you very much. Members, we have a committee coming in here. So the chair renews her motion that House File 1376 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And members, I'll see you next Tuesday. The meeting is adjourned.